Was John Brown a Civil War domestic terrorist? Was he a true abolitionist? Surely, some thought, he was deluding himself. Perhaps he was just a cold-blooded murderer. New York editor Horace Greeley gave us his answer. He simply said, "He's a madman." Brown and his followers attacked Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in October of 1859. They hoped to strike a blow against slavery, steal weapons, and in the process recruit Virginia slaves to their cause. The raid lasted 36 hours and from a military standpoint was a total failure. The attack itself has become unimportant to the understanding of the Civil War. However, the man, his emotional jailhouse testimony and trial, the nationwide reactions to his audacity and boldness, and the resulting passions for and against slavery tell us much about the Civil War. John Brown was born in Connecticut in 1800 and raised by a stern Calvinist father. John spent many years of his youth in an abolitionist region of Ohio where anti-slavery sentiment was at a fever pitch. After his first wife died, Brown's second wife, Mary Ann Day Brown, cared for John's five children and bore him 13 other children herself. The family moved a lot to Massachusetts, to New York, and Pennsylvania as John tried to establish himself. He tried farming and failed. He also went into business selling woolen goods and failed there as well. When John returned to Ohio and joined the massive land speculation there, he lost everything in the economic downturn of 1837. It was during this period in the late 1830s that Brown made some of his first public speeches against the evils of slavery. Yet financial chaos seemed to haunt him. Again in 1842, Brown's business failures erupted, this time into bankruptcy court. While we may never fully understand Brown's motives and actions during the tumultuous days to come, he clearly seemed a man deeply set against slavery. Radical pro-slave and radical free soil advocates continued to raise their voices in acrimony throughout the 1840s. The Compromise of 1850 quickly elevated this debate to a national level. It was in this explosive atmosphere that John Brown visited a New York abolitionist, Gerrit Smith. Smith had inherited his father's lands and soon endorsed reforms such as abolition and temperance. Smith decided to give away small plots of land from his vast Adirondack estates to deserving and what he called temperate poor black men. Nearly 2,000 such black men took advantage of Smith's generosity. Brown proposed that Smith sell him land as well at the bargain price of $1 an acre so that he could give the struggling black families aid. Smith agreed, and in 1848, Brown moved his family to a farm in the remote settlement of North Elba, New York, where they lived among abolitionists and freed slaves. In 1854, all eyes had been on Kansas because of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which had literally invited pro-slave and free soil advocates to join in a contest over who would make Kansas a state first, slave or free. Elections between the pro-slave and free state forces put the territory into complete turmoil. Then the contest turned bloody. On May 20, 1856, pro-slave forces sacked the free soil town of Lawrence, burning the Free Soil Hotel. As Congress heard the news, people on both sides were outraged. Senator Charles Sumner gave a lengthy and harsh speech called The Crime Against Kansas. In this speech, he condemns South Carolina Senator Andrew Butler as a Don Quixote married to the harlot of slavery. Butler's nephew, Preston Brooks, took a cane to Sumner, beating him repeatedly on the Senate floor 2 days after this harsh speech. The nation was horrified. Brooks was fined only $300, but Sumner was unable to work for 4 years. Witnesses later said that John Brown, quote, went crazy after hearing of Bleeding Kansas and Bleeding Sumner. On May 24 and 56, Brown, four of his sons, and others took five hostages from the pro-slave community of Pottawatomie and brutally murdered them by cutting off their arms, then splitting their heads open with broadswords. Those murdered had no known connections with the violence. Brown evaded capture, although a son was later killed in the Kansas Civil War, as it was called. In August of that year, Brown tried to defend the town of Osawatomie from pro-slave militia. Brown was outnumbered and made a hasty retreat, but he became a national hero to abolitionists, who now proudly proclaimed him Osawatomie Brown. Now he was influential as Osawatomie Brown, and he traveled to Boston during the winter of 1857, where he met Franklin Sanborn. Sanborn, Brown, and other abolitionists formed a group that was dedicated to abolition, and they later described themselves as the Secret Six. Sanborn was in charge of the Massachusetts State Committee for a Free Kansas and brought Thomas Wentworth Higginson into the group, as well as others. Brown and his new friends were primarily interested in raising money to send settlers to Kansas. In late January, Brown and Sanborn met with the National Kansas Committee. Witnesses later wrote complaining of Brown's violent nature, and several hoped that the national group would not endorse his ideas. For the next 3 weeks, Brown traveled throughout New York and Massachusetts trying to raise money for his project. On February 18 of 1857, Brown testified before the Massachusetts legislature in support of a $100,000 fund to defend Kansas against the pro-slavery militias. By spring, Brown was raising enough money to pay his volunteers and to order a manual, even, for his fighters. He even negotiated with a local blacksmith for the manufacture of steel-tipped spears and continued to speak up at numerous town meetings, including several where he said that he accepted violence as God's will toward pro-slavers. We get a glimpse of how earnest John Brown was during this period of fundraising and planning. As we look back at Harper's Ferry, Brown's childish tactical planning and his nearly impossible goal of inciting a slave revolt all seems unrealistic. But Brown was very convinced that a slave rebellion was possible, and he had raised funds to purchase supplies, and in July of 1859, he rented a farmhouse just outside Harper's Ferry. Now, the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry was gigantic. It was complete with dozens of buildings, and it stored 100,000 muskets and rifles. Brown and 21 followers had a simple plan to enter the armory, take weapons, alert the slaves in bondage to join them, and then retreat into the nearby mountains to fight a guerrilla-style war until slavery was ended. Brown's band of volunteers included three of his sons, a fugitive slave, a student, and a free black man. The attack began well. The telegraph wires were successfully cut, and some hostages were taken. The fighters then easily overpowered the single guard and took possession of the armory. but soon the attack broke down. A morning train bound for Washington, D.C. was allowed to leave, and U.S. Army officials were warned of Brown's insurrection just before noon, the day of the attack. Local militia then began shooting at Brown's men, forcing them to remain in the armory buildings. By evening, Brown had lost 15 men. Two had run away and escaped. Five were cut off in the sprawling arsenal buildings, and eight lay dead or mortally wounded. Brown moved his remaining force into a brick engine house near the entrance to the armory. U.S. Marines, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Robert E. Lee, surrounded the engine house. Lieutenant Jeb Stuart brought the government's offer of surrender under a white flag, but Brown refused. Lee's troops stormed the engine house. Brown narrowly escaped death, and he and four others were taken to Charlestown, Virginia, to be tried for treason. John Brown's trial made him famous and stirred heated debate in both North and South. Local and national newspapers ran so much coverage of the trial that several apologized to readers for carrying so much news from Virginia. The week-long trial and Brown's hanging were sensationalized everywhere. Pro-slave Southerners took up arms and feared more attacks, even ones that might actually produce a slave revolt. Abolitionists ignored Brown's murderous acts and proclaimed a martyr for their cause. The nation's two top weekly magazines sent reporters and sketch artists to cover the trial. Harper's Weekly got so many complaints from Northerners and Southerners alike that they actually fired a reporter. John Brown's trial and hanging changed the nation by creating a single point of differencing opinion so intense that giving in from either side was just impossible. Many historians have labeled the period of Brown's martyrdom as the vanishing point for peace. In the North, song sheets were printed, purchased, and sung by the thousands. John Brown's original marching song was one of the most popular. Ralph Waldo Emerson praised Brown as a saint. There were some level-headed American leaders who knew that the violence of Brown's cause must not be allowed to continue. Both Stephen Douglas and William Seward denounced Brown's violence. The Republicans, fearing Southern and Middle State reactions, disowned the Harper's Ferry incident in their 1860 platform. Southern leaders, moderates, and even so-called fire eaters alike saw Brown as a terrorist, pure and simple. Mobs of angry Southern whites actually attacked innocent white Northerners, assuming that any Northerner was the next potential John Brown. John Brown, with his piercing eyes, his strong face, deep commitment, and his willingness to use murderous force, became a one-man symbol for anger, hatred, mistrust, revenge, and fear.